Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 16th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Climate and Vulnerability in the Developing World, presented by Brent Lofgren. Disc number LOB-2005-04.
I don't know, I was hoping to air out this room a little bit by locking that door open. I don't know, there's going to be some disturbance from people outside. However, I'm going to be, my name is Brent Lofgren. I'm with the NOAA Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I do most of my work in the Great Lakes Basin. However, I've branched out into doing some study of climate in East Africa. Along with that, I have done some mission work with a short-term mission group from my church, and as far as the chronology of all this, I started in the planning process of this climate research project along with several scientists from Michigan State University and some from several other places. That started in 2000. Then in early 2002, I went and visited Kenya with that group for a planning meeting. Then 2003 was my first trip with the church group to Tanzania. This year, I have already gone to Kenya and will go to Tanzania again in August. So both of these are keeping me involved there. And the combined goals of these two things are to give aid to these people who are in tough economic straits and try to help them develop their nation in a way that's both compassionate and sensible and technically correct and efficient. So the way that I'm presenting is really going to be first a whole bunch of pictures from the mission trip and explain a little bit about how that operated, and then a few more sort of technical type of things from our science project and meet a few of the players in that. This is the Tanzania mission of Zion Lutheran Church in 2003. And that was our first view of Mount Gilai, which is where we spent a little over a week. Tanzania and Maasai life, we spent our time with the Maasai tribe, who are a people who depend upon grazing cattle and goats. Their traditional way of life, they don't really stick to their traditional diet anymore, but in the old days, all they would ever have to consume was meat, milk, and blood. The milk and blood being more renewable and meat being more of a sort of treat. And this is a landscape there. This is actually in its more green state. This was the rainy season, although it wasn't all that rainy as rainy seasons go, and it's hard to see on this screen, but Mount Kilimanjaro is in the background. It just kind of pokes above that line, goes horizontally across the screen. And this is a landscape near some of the bomas. The bomas are thorn enclosures that keep the domestic animals inside and wild animals outside at night. So they keep the animals in there and they also have their houses in there. This is the sign welcoming you to the village of Gilai, which is 4 hours off the paved road by car and many hours by foot, which is most people's main means of transportation. This is one of the local, he's chief of a Boma, and he was very proud of his service in the British Army during World War II. He still had his papers from that time, and he's posing in front of some of his young bulls.
Did he speak English?
He does not speak English. They were a British colony at that time, and they must have had a Swahili-speaking set of units there in Kenya. I didn't hear the part of the story whether he traveled elsewhere as part of the army. A couple of scenes, bringing in the cattle at sunset and the sort of aerial view of one of the bomas. Here's the interior of one of the bomas. Not much plants grow there. It gets kind of muddy sometimes. And the walls of the huts are sort of a stick lattice and covered over with mud and dung. And the high-tech part of it is that formerly they built the roof out of mud and dung, and having a fire for cooking inside of that made it pretty smoky in there, with no chimney and just this solid roof. Nowadays they're using the thatched roof, which helps a little bit in that respect. And one of my fellow travelers really dislikes the picture in the lower left because it has this mud hut with a crate of pop in the orange crate. And that was, we were the guests of these people to go visit their boma, but the price of admission was a crate of pop. And we shared that with them. Actually, part of the negotiations involved beer, but we got away with pop.
Did you bring that blue camp chair too?
Yeah, we brought that too. So, there are a few modern conveniences that get interjected into this kind of old way of life. And soda pop is something that is considered sort of an affordable status symbol there. People really want to be able to have that every once in a while to show that they can afford something other than what they make themselves. This is the marketplace, and anyone here from northeastern Minnesota? Okay, the one guy is wearing the Bear Grease Sled Dog Race shirt there. That's up in northeast Minnesota, and that shirt belonged to me as of when I went over there, but now it belongs to him. Or Raphael, he was one of our sort of guides there and spoke pretty good English and helped us around. And there's some difficulty in transferring your mindset between the United States and over there. This is market day. Every Friday is when the guy on the left in the black cap would come into town with his market truck, and there are a few other people who would do the same, and he has his things to sell. But after we left there, Raphael would say to us, "What kind of things do you buy on market day in your town?" And we had to sort of explain to him that every day is market day, and Meijer is open 24 hours a day. So that's a difficult concept for them. And one of the commandments of going over there was, don't take pictures without permission. Now, we had Raphael as our guide, and one of our other members started pointing her camera around and saying, "Is it okay to take a picture?" And Raphael here was being kind of pulled in all different directions at that point, and maybe said yes to someone else, and Lois took that as an okay to snap the picture, and the guy in the black cap became very angry after she snapped this picture. He called her a thief. He knew that much English, at least.
Yeah, she was. She stole his portrait.
Yeah, because she took the picture. I think it's really that they want to be paid for having their picture taken. And those sandals are made out of tire treads. Mm-hmm. And that's very standard for people to wear those kind of sandals. Here's just kind of a scenic shot at sunrise looking to the east toward Mount Kilimanjaro, looking up at the top. Another couple of scenic shots, and as a meteorologist, I was interested in the one at the lower left, which was somewhat typical there. There was a ridge of mountains to our east, and it was very typical for the clouds to come right up to that ridge and stop. And we were awaiting rain, but often it would just kind of stop on that side of the ridge. It was the rainy season. We got rain a couple of times, but not a whole lot. Okay, I guess I didn't mention the names of our hosts. It's Dr. Steve Freeberg, who's a missionary doctor there, and his parent organization is Global Health Ministries, headquartered in Minneapolis. These are his twin sons, Zaka on the left and Yika on the right, and his wife Bethany, and a lot of people get a chuckle out of her holding that big knife right behind her two sons. And that's me on the left. And this is the doctor in action, and one of the nurses who was in our group got a kick out of this. She said he went to examine patients wearing flip-flops, and you can see some of the green paint stains on his hands, because we were also busy painting in the staff quarters for this clinic. And this is Bethany again with their daughter Shalai. And you can see the Pepsi advertisement in the back. This is in the city of Arusha. And this is their house with a couple of donkeys just hanging out outside of it. And this is considered a pretty luxurious house. It's made out of cinder blocks. And no running water inside, but they don't have to go too far for a spigot. Then they have to filter and boil all their water, except for what they use to flush the toilet with a bucket. They have a toilet that is basically a hole in the floor with a sewer going outside, and then you flush it by pouring a bucket into it.
Are the donkeys work animals, or?
Yeah. The Maasai use them to carry various things, mm-hmm. notably water. Mm-hmm. And this is their means of transportation. Dr. Freeberg has a whole string of clinics throughout northern Tanzania and drives back and forth with them. And at two different times when I was there, we had 18 people in this pickup. Mm-hmm. Not when it was loaded with so much stuff. And one time, one guy was sitting on top of the cab with a spear right next to him.
I wouldn't agree.
Okay, here's what the Freebergs do. In the town of Gilai, they have this little clinic, and people walk from 10 miles or more to come to the clinic and just line up outside and wait their turn. And the tents are where we stayed. So here he is with one of his patients. Actually, she looks like she has some green paint on her hands. And that's one of our group on the right. And the guy on the left is the language interpreter. Dr. Freeberg has basically native fluency in Swahili, which is kind of the national language of Tanzania, along with English, which fewer people speak. But a lot of the people in this area speak only Maasai. So the guy on the left, although he has very little English, he translates between Maasai and Swahili. And you can see all the jewelry on this patient. And a lot of the men like to wear those knit stocking caps. So here are a couple scenes. The supply closet at that clinic and working with a patient. Then the mothers like to, they are encouraged to bring their babies in for regular weighing just to make sure that they're growing at a good rate. And also the women there purposely don't eat very much while they're pregnant in order to have small babies to avoid problems in childbirth. And those are my clothes drying up on the upper right. There were had to ask permission to take this photograph, and there was a certain amount of negotiation that went on in that too.
What's the average birth weight of babies there? Or, yeah, considered an average birth weight?
I think it's around 4 pounds, maybe even less.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And there they are weighing the babies.
It doesn't seem, everyone, I don't see it from anything emaciation or anything, so it seems people are reasonably fed.
No, at that time, they were eating reasonably well, and general health of the population was okay. And it really is, you know, kind of a, it's a vulnerable situation, but it's not always bad for them. So at that time they were good. I think later on that year and the next year, they were having more hard times.
And did they receive any kind of aid at all, or, you know, sort of from the global aid networks and stuff, or were they fairly self-sufficient?
At this time they weren't receiving food aid. They get this medical aid through Global Health Ministries, and another thing that helps to support that is that the government provides free of charge vaccines. Mm-hmm. So they just turn over the vaccines to these doctors, and they administer it to the patients, and it's really the biggest bang for the buck to have as your basic programs, just weighing the babies to make sure they're growing, vaccinate them. Those are simple things to do, but have a big effect.
And a long lasting effect.
Yeah.
It's not just for today, it's for their lives.
Yeah, no, this is a small hospital ward that was pretty much built at that time, but hadn't yet been furnished. It's going to have about 20 beds in it. And actually, they were looking more for just sort of mattress pads rather than actual beds, because the people aren't comfortable being in beds. Anyway, this building cost about $20,000 to build, and our church provided about half of that. So it's a pretty inexpensive building, built of cinder blocks with a corrugated metal roof. There's another shot of it. This is in another hospital ward that's part of their complex in a more populated and busy area. It's right along the road between Arusha, which is kind of the main city in the interior of Tanzania, and Ngorongoro Crater, which is a major tourist destination. And they had just completed the blacktop road up to this point, which is a town called Mtowambu, which translates as River of Mosquitoes. And they were continuing to build that blacktop toward Ngorongoro Crater. And these twin boys had some stomach ailments at that time, and the mother was staying at the hospital along with them. These are some of the staff there. Some other sick people there. And this is what the church looks like in Gilai. Largely the same construction as those houses. It's got that stick lattice alone in this one end, and then parts of the walls are built with mud and dung, and they were extremely proud that their roof is corrugated metal, that they were able to afford that. Here's the interior, and anyone want to guess what the rocks are for?
Seats.
Yep, those are their pews. They'd pull those rocks out from the wall and sit on them.
Holy ground.
And then this was part of the Sunday offering that particular day. Someone just brought in a chicken, and it's a live chicken. And then at the end of the service, they converted it into cash by auctioning it off. And Dr. Freeberg had a couple of his assistants as plants in the audience there, and they bid against each other and bid it up to a relatively high price. And our group got to eat it later on, and I was picking that chicken from my teeth for quite a long time after that. So, what our group did, there's a picture of our group. Ages ranged from 14 up to 60-something. We're planning to go again this year, and the youngest is 13. And Lois in the center there was our oldest member. I'm not sure exactly what her age is, but it's 2 years older than it was in 2003. She's going again. And our tent accommodations are on the left, and our toilet accommodations are on the right. Just squatted over that. Actually, this time there will be a flush toilet available. That's part of the renovation. Here's a broader view of the clinic complex. On the left is the building for the clinic itself, and on the right is the staff quarters. Basically, they're going to have three staff living in there along with their families in fairly small quarters. And the doctor is the senior person there at a salary of $75 a month, plus this lodging here. And here we are painting to spiff up the quarters there for the staff. And this is work on paving the courtyard there. We brought in a whole bunch of flat rocks, just took them from the ravine, and in this country that would be considered stealing. But over there, I guess it was okay. Here we are hauling the rocks in on the pickup, and I'm in the background. I need to shave there, and just posing for a picture. We were told we need to go and find some newborn baby goats, and one of the Bomas happened to have some after we had done a bunch of trudging around to find them. And there I am with baby goat and the yellow-green Nalgene bottle that was my constant companion.
What was the purpose of finding baby goats?
Just to see how cute they were and get our pictures taken of them. So here's some pictures of wildlife. We got a chance to go aside and see Ngorongoro Crater, flamingos, Cape Buffalo, zebras. The elephant and giraffe here are in a different area, Tarangire National Park. Hippos, some of the people we met. This is kind of the entire group we worked with. the group that we traveled with, plus the Freebird family and a bunch of the locals. Frankie was brought in from outside. He was he's trained as a mason and did a lot of the construction supervision. These are some of the locals. This is the nurse at the clinic. And Raphael was one of our guides. These are a couple of the kids. This guy in the front here was a deaf mute. Mm-hmm. And it seems that he's really going to be dependent on other people for pretty much his whole life. He's under the care of Stephen, the watchman at the clinic, who is some sort of relative of his. I wasn't quite clear on that. But he's not able to go to school there. Now here comes the science part of it, which we call the Climate Land Interaction Project in East Africa. And some of the people that work with me are from Michigan State University. Nathan Moore does some similar things to what I do in climate modeling. Jeff Andresen has expertise in interactions between climate and agriculture. David Campbell and Jennifer Olson have expertise in human geography. They're interested in looking at human systems and how people make a living in different locations. And Brian Pijanowski has developed a bunch of computer algorithms for how land use might react given different stimuli, including climate, also such things as roads and electrical power supply and other factors such as that. And actually that's only the start of our list of collaborators, and I'll especially point out the ones that are in Africa. There's the International Livestock Research Institute in Nairobi, Kenya, Makerere University in Kampala, Uganda, and then near the upper right, I'll mention North Carolina State University. Frederick Samazi is originally from Uganda, and his grandfather was the king of Uganda back when they, I think he was actually kind of more of a puppet king while it was an English colony. University of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, and University of Nairobi in Kenya. And what we're trying to investigate here is how this entire system fits together, and really the loop starts at any point on here, but I'll start from the top, the climate dynamics, which is what I'm working with. We're doing some observational studies and computer modeling of how the climate may act in this area. And then, as a result of that, we go over to the left, net primary productivity simulations. We're looking at how agricultural systems and grazing animal systems might work given a certain climate, and then also natural vegetation type of systems. So then that leads to land use change at the bottom, which is to say how people will react to these changes in agricultural productivity, whether they'll start irrigating more or shifting between agriculture and herding, and whether some people might be moving to urban areas. Then on the right is land cover, which is distinguished from land use in that land use really refers to how humans are determining what their environment is going to be. Then land cover really refers to the actual physical characteristics of the land. The main physical characteristics we're interested in are how much light is going to be reflected from the surface. A sort of dry grassland grazing area will reflect a lot more light than a well-watered cropland will. And that's something that is potentially of importance to the climate there. And we're also interested in the leaf area index, the number of leaves in a given location will help to determine how much evaporation is going to happen there. And also, a lot of leaves and taller trees will cause friction and slow down the wind near the surface as well. So those are all things that potentially influence the climate. Then in the center is the box that says integrative. So we're really trying to draw together all of these four boxes. Then the yellow boxes at the top and bottom are really influences that happen externally to this. Under global climate, you can include greenhouse warming and other effects such as El Nino, which is an important remote effect from this area. And then human systems on the bottom would, some of that would stem from government policies, changes in population, and all sorts of things that come from human demand for land use. One of the important concepts that we use here is something known as the Charney mechanism, because it was invented by a guy named Jules Charney back in the 1970s. And this is basically a positive feedback where the contrast between desert and forest, basically lighter colored and darker colored surface, tends to be enhanced by redistributing where the rain falls. The desert on the right reflects a lot of sunlight and therefore transfers less heat into the atmosphere, and therefore you tend to have a sinking motion. Also, I should mention this is most valid in the tropical regions, less valid in mid-latitude regions like we're at, but highly valid in East Africa. Then on the left is the forest with much darker color to it. It will absorb more sunlight and have more energy to transfer into the atmosphere. Now, some of that energy will be transferred directly as heat, and then other of it will be transferred as latent heat, which means the heat that is required to evaporate water. So as that water evaporates, it consumes energy from that forest, but then there's that rising motion of the air there, which the air cools as it does that, and the water condenses. When it condenses, it releases that latent heat. So that cycle of energy is continued. So the contrast in color between the desert and forest helps to perpetuate this circulation drawn by the arrows. It's a positive feedback. So anyway, I talked about the Maasai earlier. Does anyone want to say what's wrong with this picture?
Maasai, I heard you say it's an agriculturalist.
Yep, in general, you're correct. But here in the area of Loitokituk and Urambo, on the lower slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro, just on the Kenya side, they are farming. And a couple of reasons why they've switched from herding to farming. One is that their land ownership has been adjudicated. That's the term they use. And what they do is the government says, you can no longer own this land communally. So the former communal ownership enabled all the members of the local tribe to run their animals all over that communally owned land. And the government said, this family gets this plot of land, and they just draw lines around it on the map. And therefore, they each have only small plots of land where it's impractical to raise animals, so they've shifted to farming. And also, the government sponsored an irrigation project. So just off of this picture to the right, there's a large irrigation ditch. It's just an open ditch with water in it, and then they can dig some smaller furrows that branch off of that to water their fields. Yeah.
Now, is this in Tanzania or Kenya or both?
My earlier pictures were from Tanzania. This is in Kenya, but it's...
But I mean that government edict. Has that been for covering both areas?
This particular case only covers a very small area within Kenya. But there is a trend toward doing that in a variety of areas. Yeah.
What does the government see as the benefit of doing that? What do they care?
I think it's just kind of orderliness and having a title for an individual to a piece of land.
Are there, yet another case here in the 21st century of indigenous peoples being forced off their land and having governments telling, it's like, I don't know why I should be surprised that this is still happening, but I am. Is there people sort of advocating on their behalf as far as to bring back their communal property rights or something? Or, not to go in that direction with this, but I'm just curious.
I don't know if anyone's doing this.
Wow.
Did it have anything to do with intertribal arguments? Right?
I don't really know. One of the things that happened on the day when I visited here was our group had an interview with a bunch of elders there, and really quite old guys, and they talked about the old days when they just herded cattle and certain times when they had a severe drought and things were really bleak. And the very old guys really lamented the loss of that. The younger guys were very happy farming. They thought that their lot was better by doing that. And these guys right here, the field where they're standing right now looks like a lot of weeds to me. And I see one little tomato right at the bottom. Mm-hmm. I think there are a few green ones in there, but they're very proud of that, and very much of a staple crop is maize in the background. Mm-hmm. Further in the background, you can see a few banana trees sticking up. And from the roads in this area, all you could see was maize. But once we got on foot and back in there, we saw tomatoes, bananas, oranges, mangoes, passion fruit, watermelon, and just a few sunflowers for cooking oil.
Do they still keep like small herds or small, few animals around? Or?
No, they don't. Basically nowhere in East Africa, well, there are a couple of places where I saw fences, but there are very few fences there. So, in order to have water both for agriculture and herding, you really have to keep them separate. And there are tribal conflicts over that. There are the farming tribes, and they set themselves up near water in order to be able to irrigate. And then there are the herding tribes who don't like to have farming near the water because they want to run their herds through there in order to get them a drink.
Okay. do the farmers generally, who supplies them with seed?
You know, actually, one of the things that was a bit of a surprise to me, my father used to work for Pioneer Seed, and he was in sunflower research there, and I went to Loitokitok in Kenya, right on the border with Tanzania, and on this side street there was a sign saying Pioneer Seeds.
Oh my gosh.
And they had hybrid corn available there. I'm really not sure to what extent they're actually planting hybrid corn, because the second generation of it is no longer hybrid, and I don't know if they're just keeping the seed that they produce themselves to plant the next year.
Because, I mean, it looks like pretty, it reminds me of Iowa. I mean,
yeah.
It's really close together.
Yeah.
So it seems like they must have some sort of, it could be like their indigenous corn would be that tall or that close together. I mean,
right.
In my mind.
Right. Well, there is no indigenous corn in that.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. But this is an area of a microclimate where there is a fair amount of water available. It's partway up Mount Kilimanjaro, and also they're irrigating it to some extent because there's plenty of water available there. If farms continue to expand, it may be questionable whether that irrigation is sustainable. So some of the more technical aspects, we're trying to do some modeling of the atmosphere and the climate there, and we've worked up a model with grid spacing of 64 kilometers on this outer grid, which covers most of Africa and part of the Indian Ocean, and then in our main area of interest, which consists of Tanzania, Kenya, and Uganda, there's a 16 kilometer spacing. This takes a lot of computing resources to run this. Now we want to check whether it's correct, and for that, radiosonde is a fancy word for weather balloon. So we want to look at that data, but it's pretty sparse. These are the only five regularly available radiosonde stations in sub-Saharan Africa. Then some observational analysis by our colleagues at University of East Anglia in England. They looked at a few different boxes, and those two red boxes near the top kind of straddle the equator, and then the one near the bottom is several degrees south of the equator. And this was sort of known, but reaffirmed in this study. This shows the number of days in each month that have rainfall. So it's January on the left, December on the right. Layantonde is in that box in Uganda near the equator, and that has two localized maxima throughout the year of rainfall. They have two rainy seasons, two dry seasons each year. And basically the same happens in Nairobi. And then in Iringa, which is in southern Tanzania, there's really only one rainfall maximum, one rainy season, one dry season per year. And the difference is that the rain belt moves north and south. It moves north in our summer, and it moves south in the southern hemisphere summer. So for the places in the middle near the equator, it passes over in each direction. So they get a rainy season twice a year. Going to the net primary productivity in agriculture, we're using models called series maize, which predicts the amount of maize production given input from climate, and then there's also a pasture component to that too. And LPJ is an acronym for the places where it was developed in former East Germany, Leipzig, Potsdam, and Jena. And that is determining what kind of natural vegetation might occur given a certain kind of climate. And this is just sort of a schematic of what might happen in the future to crop yields. And this really is made up data. It's just a schematic, but if you have a historical climate following the blue curve, usually you've got this higher yield shown by that maximum. If you have a future climate that reduces the average yield, it's going to follow that red curve, and the vertical line labeled threshold yield is the break-even point for making it economically worthwhile. So in this hypothetical projected future climate, it's much more frequent that you fall below the threshold yield. Under land use modeling and assessment, one of the first steps is trying to come up with categories of land use, and there are three major schemes that we've looked at for this. On the left is Olson Global Ecosystem. Center is Global Land Cover 2000, and on the right is AfriCover. And each of these uses kind of a slightly different system of classifying what the land uses are, and therefore you see rather different colorations in these maps. Also, let me point out that on each of these maps, kind of the bullseye in the lower right corner is Mount Kilimanjaro. It doesn't really show up so much on the OGE there. And then the red arrows point toward Nairobi, where urban area is coded as red. And because of different criteria used for saying that this is an urban area, the amount of red on those is different among the three. So there's some confusion about really which of these is most worthwhile to use. And in a lot of ways, the AfriCover is the one that should be preferred because it's got the best spatial resolution and has some of the best data in it. The biggest problem with that one is while it was intended to cover all of Africa, it does not include Ethiopia, which is right on the edge of where we're really interested in.
I have a question about that. Mm-hmm. Most of them seem to have mostly yellow. What does the yellow stand for?
The yellow is grassland,
yeah.
Savanna type of thing.
But not deserts, curious?
There's no place on this map that's really considered desert. If you were to go way into northern Kenya, you'd see some stuff that's more like desert and some of southern Tanzania as well. Then this is a problem we had with the model that we're working on fixing, and I believe are pretty close to doing it. The climate model really assumes that plants act like they do at middle latitudes, like where we're at. And before I said there's near the equator, there are two rainy seasons and two dry seasons, whereas here there's one warm season where plants grow. And the timing of those doesn't line up, and there are two of them there. So instead of saying that the plants are greener during the summer, you've really got to say they get green toward the end of the rainy season. And this is something we need to account for. And I'll just sort of skip past this. This is a comparison of the names of the classifications in those schemes. And this gives some indication of how the classification names line up with what you see on the ground, and in some cases they may be a little questionable. Up on the top right there you have rain-fed herbaceous, which means cropland, and there's just kind of a little patch of cropland there. Bare rock on the lower left, where actually it's a wetland, and urban is something quite different from what urban would be in the United States. It's not paved, it's kind of more of a dirt and tin shacks. I'll just skip past that. And then a consolidated assessment of uncertainty. We really want to look at how much uncertainty builds up, especially when we go not only modeling climate, but going through that entire loop. You tend to build up some uncertainty at every step. And then watch out for who's on the next slide. Donald Rumsfeld is quoted as saying something that sounds like a bunch of crazy words, but it makes some sense if you really think hard about it. One of the things you need to worry about are unknown unknowns. So if there's something that just kind of pops up without your expecting it, that would be an unknown unknown.
And military is clearly the best way to prepare for this. I'm sorry.
Okay, so some of the parts of the whole picture of uncertainty are, one, statistical analysis. Then there's qualitative analysis, where some of the pieces of a whole might just be different things than you expected. Unknown and not understood, which seems to be basically what Rumsfeld was talking about in that previous quote. And incorrectly assumed. If we make a model based on some assumption, that assumption might turn out to be incorrect. So going back to this, you know, we like to think that we're making the proper assessment of this whole thing, but each step in this chain brings in a new piece of uncertainty. And going back to the yellow boxes, it's feeding in from the outside. There's uncertainty about what the global climate will be that will feed this, and what the human systems will be, what's going to be the population, who's going to be in power there making the decisions. We're trying to provide good advice to them, but are they going to listen? And are we correct? So that's it. Then acknowledgments of the groups who funded this project. And that's the end. I'll welcome questions.
But in the end, what kind of advice will you be able to give?
We will be able to give them advice on to what extent the climate and human systems will feed back on each other, whether the climate will be adversely affected by some change in human land use that might be
happening. Has this kind of information been helpful anywhere in the United States, been implemented?
I really don't think that much has been done with connection between climate and land use in the United States. Things have had more to do with hydrology, such as runoff. If you pave so much of the land and don't replace the wetlands, that gives you problems with runoff.
Who's the them that was getting the advice that
you're... It's the national governments in that region. Yeah, and...
We have trouble with farmers and land use planning in the States. But
right.
What evidence do you have that that would have any impact in Kenya?
Really, it's that the governments there are asking for it, even though we're being funded by the United States government. It's being driven by requests from the governments there.
Does this, I mean, could this potentially influence practices such that will reduce, you know, contributions to global warming, et cetera, et cetera? Or
I would say it's kind of tough to reduce contributions to global warming from Kenya and Tanzania.
They don't contribute.
Right.
No, well, that's what I'm saying. It's looking, I mean, like, for instance, if China were asking for these kinds of things, who's mm-hmm. on the verge of becoming a huge contributor because they're now are acquiring all kinds of cars. So I'm thinking down in the future, and I'm thinking of American corporations that would love to, you know, establish some global warming producing factories in
yeah, well,
for instance, so, and, you know.
We've done some talk about carbon sequestration in the soil there, and that has been really suggested by NSF, the funders of this project, and whether that's going to be a feedback. And I had a real problem with that because the carbon dioxide is a global thing, and its effects are spread all over the globe. So if we're looking only at a tiny piece of the globe and how much carbon it's sequestering, that doesn't give
right.
much of an answer to what's happening to carbon dioxide all over the globe.
Is there some Did you study the climate change, recent climate change in Tanzania and Kenya? Is there any, or?
Yeah, it's fairly faint. There's some increase in temperature. It's generally less than a degree Celsius over the last century.
Are they losing some of the wetland?
They're losing wetland areas, especially in the northwestern part of Kenya and on its border with Sudan. The southern part of Sudan is called the Sud, which is basically a latticework of, it's the Nile River splitting off into a whole bunch of little pieces that turn into wetlands. And then at the other end, it sort of geels into something, and a lot of that is being converted into agriculture. All right.